Thanks to Indeed for supporting the Productivity Show. Indeed knows that hiring needs to be cost-effective when you're running your own business. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at indeed.com/TPS. Terms and conditions apply, and cost per application pricing is not available for everyone. Thanks also to Rocket Money for supporting the show. Rocket Money will quickly and easily identify your subscriptions for you so you can stop paying for the ones you don't want. So stop throwing your money away. Cancel unwanted subscriptions and manage your expenses the easy way by going to rocketmoney.com/TPS.
All right, welcome back to the Productivity Show. So today we're going to be talking about a new app that will replace Notion, and it's not what you think it is. And also, speaking of productivity apps, we'll be sharing with you how to pick the right productivity apps that best suit you. And if you're struggling with doing a weekly review, we have some stuff for you here today as well. And also, we're going to be talking about breaking bad habits. There's a lot of stuff we're going to be covering today. Welcome to the Productivity Show, a podcast where we believe that knowledge workers like you can get everything done without having to sacrifice your health, family, and things that matter to you. If it's your first time listening, welcome to the show. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Tam Pham. I'm the founder and CEO of Asian Efficiency, where we help people become more productive at work and in life. And we have online courses and in-person workshops and coaching where we help people live their best life possible. And today I'm joined by my co-host of the Productivity Show, Brooks Duncan, who is the COO of Asian Efficiency. And we came from completely different backgrounds when it comes to productivity. I started Asian Efficiency back in 2011 as a passion project, and it accidentally turned into an online business that it is today. And Brooks came from the corporate world. Brooks had a very illustrious career. And Brooks, would you mind sharing what your career was like before you joined the AE team?
I was an accountant, and then I was a software developer, and then I was a director of client services in a small startup that got bought a few times, ended up being in a large global corporation, and I sat in way too many meetings that I did not need to be in, and that's what made me realize there has to be a better way for this stuff. So I got into GTD, getting things done, which led me to Asian Efficiency, which led me to be the second ever guest on the Productivity Show. But now you're stuck with me every week as we have this podcast to help people become more productive at work and in life. We really believe that happy people are productive people. That's a theme every week when we share tips, we share strategies, we have guests sometimes, or sometimes we have episodes like this one where it's the two of us. But either way, we're always focusing on those actionable productivity tips and insights. And we really love getting feedback. So we get a lot of feedback from listeners. One in particular that jumped out at me this week is from Appadoct. And Appadoct writes, "The Asian Efficiency podcast is not only useful to improve your productivity, but also your life. Thank you, guys." And thank you so much for sharing that, Appadoct. I really like that, because that final one is the important point. Productivity is about living your life, right? It's not about checking boxes off your to-do list. It's not about just getting more done throughout the day. Really, it's about improving your life. And so if you want to get in touch with us, leave us a review in Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you want to share suggestions for topics, you can email us anytime at podcast@asianefficiency.com. All right, Tan, we're going to get into the topic, but like we do every single episode, we're going to start with our top three resources. So these are three things that we're loving lately that are making us more productive or just making our life better, as AppDoc says. And number one is Fireflies. And that is a bot that attends your meeting. So you invite it to your meeting. And then what it will do is it will record the meeting, it will transcribe it and make it easily searchable. So it solves that problem of everyone taking their own notes and everyone recording different things. You've got Fireflies covering it for you. That's number one. Number two is the Anker 20 watt USB-C 321 power strip. So what this is it's a travel power strip. You don't have to use it for travel. You could use it around the house as well. And it's kind of like a ball with a cord at the end. And the ball has three plugins. It has USB-A. It has a USB-C power delivery, which most of these type of things don't have. And I took it on a recent trip to Central America, and it was really, really helpful. If I was one bagging it, it might be a little heavy for that. But if you are using a suitcase, it's really great. That's the Anker 20 watt USB-C power strip. And number three, speaking of that trip to Central America, I'm going to give another shout out to Aralo, which I first learned about from you, Tan. And we've mentioned on the podcast before, but it was so clutch on that recent Central American trip. And what that is it's an eSIM app. So anywhere you're going in the world, and my kids were playing with it, looking at all the different countries that it's in, you just get an eSIM. So you don't have to go and stand in line to get a SIM card when you travel somewhere. It just does it all for you. And I've used it in six different countries now, and it's been seamless every time. So that is Aralo. And you can find links to everything that we share in the show notes by going to theproductivityshow.com, or just swipe in your podcast app, or find us on YouTube at theproductivityshow.com/YouTube. All right, Tan. So we are going to start doing the roundup. So what we like to do in these episodes is start with some news items that are catching our eye. And I'm going to grab the first one, if you don't mind. And that is this rumored Notion killer, which is finally available for preview. So we've talked about this on the podcast before, but it's called Microsoft Loop. And you can now try it out yourself. You can go to loop.microsoft.com/learn. And what Loop is they say it's designed for co-creation. It says it brings your team and ideas together in one place. And the killer feature for me anyway is that it has Loop components that can go across all the different Microsoft 365 apps. So if you use Outlook, if you use Teams, you can use those Loop components in your other Microsoft apps. And of course, like everyone else, they're integrating AI tools by a Microsoft Copilot, so you can develop your Loop dashboards with the assistance of AI. What do you think of this, Tan? Does Loop look better than, say, Notion?
It's interesting. When I was reading the article, when they were talking about it, I looked at the screenshot and I was like, okay, this kind of looks like Notion in many ways. If you put Notion side to side to Microsoft Loop, you would go, okay, they kind of look the same, which is funny. And because Microsoft has this already huge customer base, like they have millions of users right away, if they release an app like this, it will instantly have adoption, which is very powerful when you have such a powerful ecosystem. Just like when you're Apple, if you release a new app, millions of people will have it right away on their phones because you own the network and the ecosystem, because you create the hardware for people that have the platform and device that you want to launch it onto. So the fact that Microsoft is releasing this, and we are calling it the Notion killer because, one, it looks like Notion, and two, it has pretty much the same features. I can see how if anybody who is in the Microsoft ecosystem right now is thinking about, hey, I've been using Notion for a little bit now, but I need to use this within my own company. It makes sense to make the switch over, because if you can have everything in one ecosystem, it's just much easier to include meeting notes, to include notes and emails, to send stuff to different people. And if you watch any of the announcements that they've made with Copilot, where, if you don't know, Microsoft Copilot is kind of like the ChatGPT, if you may will, of Microsoft, built into the ecosystem. And so you can have it do all these crazy things like, hey, prepare me for the meeting that's coming up in 1 hour. And it can pull out the meeting notes from the ecosystem that you have and pull up different references of other things that we're mentioning in the meeting notes, and then summarize it for you, and then also create a task list and help you prepare for it. And it's a really powerful thing. So if you haven't seen this yet, go to youtube.com, search for Microsoft Copilot, look for the announcement video, because it will just blow your mind. Like, I was so impressed. I don't know about you, Brooks, but I was so impressed by it that I was like, where's Apple, first and foremost? But also, too, I always talk about how I would only switch apps if it's 10 times better. Microsoft Copilot is like 100 times better than what is available right now. Like, I'm that appalled by it, and I'm so drawn to the fact that I might actually switch over.
It's funny you mentioned Apple, because that's what everyone keeps saying, right? Apple must have some secret AI project that they're working on in the background, and they're going to drop it and it's going to wow us all. But then I look at Siri and I think, I don't know. I mean, I hope it's true, but we'll see. I think with Loop, the closest example I can think of with Loop is Teams. So Teams didn't kill Slack. I mean, we use Slack. Lots of companies use Slack. But if you look at the graphs of adoption, if you look at the graphs of monthly active users, you can see that, well, this is going to be great on Audible podcast, but you can see that Slack's adoption is pretty flat. People who use it still use it, but that's about it. Whereas the Teams is the total hockey stick, right? Anyone who is already in the Microsoft ecosystem, even if Teams isn't as quote unquote good as Slack, it almost doesn't matter. I think most companies would take a app that is about the same or maybe not even as good if it has those integrations. And I think that's what we're going to see with Loop. I think Notion will be just fine. Maybe Killer is a little strong, but I think Loop, if Microsoft does it right.
I think another way of thinking about it is if you're not in the Microsoft ecosystem, then Notion is like the best way to go, right? If you are in a Microsoft ecosystem, which many of us are that are listening, then something like Loop makes a lot of sense. And if you, for example, in your day job, use Microsoft, but in your personal life, don't use it, you can use both or choose either or. And I like the analogy that you use with Slack versus Teams. And again, we'll link to the graph here that Brooks mentioned here in the show notes so you can see it. But like Slack hasn't really grown as much in terms of number of users because it has to do so much marketing to adopt all these new people and onboard them. Whereas, you know, Microsoft has been around for decades, and because they have so many corporate users and people all over the world using it for decades now, that if they just drop a new app, like there'll be instant adoption. And so I can see, to your point, that they don't have to be as good as Notion to get that many users to use it, especially with Copilot being integrated. I can see how it will actually become more of a Notion killer in that sense because it has all these AI features. However, Notion is also adopting AI features in the platform as well. So I'd be curious to see how it goes head to head over time. But the fact that Notion is already using AI tech to make the platform better, I think that's a huge competitive edge compared to other note-taking apps. And this is something that I've mentioned in other podcasts before too, is any app that is willing to adopt AI tech or will build on top of that will be the number one or market leader most likely in that category of apps. That's something I'm a firm believer of. And I was just at NAPO where I was giving a keynote. And by the way, Brooks, many people were missing you at the conference because they know they listen to the podcast and they like you. And you've spoken there a few years ago too. But many people that mentioned the podcast, I also talked to them about note-taking apps and other apps that they use. And they don't talk about AI stuff whatsoever. So it's kind of like, if you're listening to the Productivity Show and you know about AI, you maybe even use some of it, you're already way ahead of the curve. So congratulations on that. But also too, a lot of people are still using other note-taking apps. Like Evernote is still a popular thing. A lot of people who are NAPO members are Evernote certified users or consultants, which by the way, I heard they have scrapped that program now. So it doesn't even exist anymore moving forward. And so the rumor was, at least at the conference, was that Evernote is going to stay the same as it is and they're not going to make any drastic changes. That's what I've been told when I was there. And so hot off the press here on the podcast, but I'm still a little bit wary about it. So I'm not going to recommend it quite yet. It's still to be seen.
All right. Another development I wanted to make note of is the Remarkable 2 tablet, which we've mentioned a number of times. A lot of TPS listeners love their Remarkable 2, which is an e-ink tablet, and people like it because it is really easy to read. It has a stylus that works really well. But the development that I did not see coming was that Remarkable has released a keyboard folio for it. So they are trying to turn it into something that you would do a lot of writing on as well. And by all reports, it's a really nice device for distraction-free typing. That's what a lot of people who are doing writing like or think they want anyway, is this distraction-free environment. And if you think about it, that is actually not a bad idea because that's what people say they like about the Remarkable 2 in the first place for reading and taking notes is it's distraction free. It's not like an iPad where you might have notifications from Discord or something coming in, right? It's totally clean. So now they're giving you a distraction free writing environment. The only thing about it is that it is kind of expensive. Like the keyboard itself is $199. So when you start adding in the Remarkable and the stylus, because you're not going to have a Remarkable without the stylus, and then you add in this keyboard folio, it's starting to add up to quite a bit of money. But you could also say that this might be a good way to differentiate the Remarkable from the Kindle Scribe.
Interesting development. It's not something mind-blowing. It doesn't really surprise me either, the fact that they added this keyboards. Like I said, the pricing is interesting because if you buy the stylus, the Remarkable itself and the keyboard, it's like close to $500, if not more. And so you're like, well, at that point, you might as well buy a laptop and just put, you know, freedom.2 or something on it. So you can have distraction-free writing if that's what you're aiming for, right? Or you use a Surface tablet and you can use a lot of the same features and just put it on lockdown so it can be distraction-free as well. So it's not a huge differentiator except for the fact that it has an e-ink screen, which I think is kind of nice. But what made Remarkable 2 so powerful and popular was the fact that it was, one, very portable, two, has an e-ink screen. And so I'm still curious to see if the keyboard is going to take off, because the pricing just doesn't make a lot of sense, because you can just have a laptop with that kind of money. Whereas with the stylus and the tablet itself, you're kind of below the price point of a laptop. And so that's that kind of like sweet spot category of pricing wise. But then if you just want to add a keyboard, you know, you might as well get a laptop at that point. So I personally don't see the value in it myself. I don't have a Remarkable 2 either. I'm more likely to get either the Remarkable 2 or the Scribe at some point, just for pure note-taking and writing stuff down, because that's the main reason why many of us would get something like this. If I really wanted to type stuff, like I have a MacBook Air that does that, and it kind of does the job for what I need. I don't see myself carrying a tablet with a keyboard plus a MacBook Air as well. Like, that seems kind of redundant.
Well, one thing I will say, take it from me, is you know how when you go through TSA or whatever and they make you take your laptop out but not your iPad? Well, I do have a keyboard attached to my iPad. And one thing I have learned the hard way is that if you have a keyboard attached to your iPad, they want it out as well. They consider that to be a laptop. So, lesson learned. All right, the next topic I want to bring up is, and this shows the danger of talking about such a fast-moving topic as AI, and that is that Midjourney stops their free trials after deepfake images go viral. And so back in our AI episode, TPS 441, we talked about Midjourney, which is an AI platform. It's based on Discord, and what this lets you do is create images based on prompts. And the better you get at working out what the prompts are, the better images you can get. And we talked about how you could sign up for Midjourney, have a certain number of free images, and then you have to pay after that. Well, apparently, the CEO calls it extraordinary demand and trial abuse. They are getting rid of the free trials and you basically have to pay. And this didn't used to be a problem, really, because you could kind of tell AI-generated images. Like in that AI episode, you could tell that those images that we posted as examples were not real. They're just a little off. Maybe the hands were a little big or just something was a little off about them. But now the platforms are improving so fast that there were images of Trump getting arrested. Those were totally fake. There were images of the Pope looking baller in a swagged out coat that went viral. I don't know if you ever saw that, Tan. And there's more to come. And the funny thing about this is, you know, we talked about the power of AI, but these are also some of the worries. Like those images I talked about look completely real. In fact, just this last weekend, I don't know how we got on the topic of the Pope, but we were talking about it. And all of a sudden, my son, who's 18, goes, "Oh, the Pope, he's a dog." I'm like, "Let me guess. You saw the pictures of him in the Balenciaga coat, right?" And he says, "Yeah." I said, "That's not real." He did not believe me. He thought it was completely real. So this is the dangerous area that we're getting into.
It's funny that your son said that, because when I first saw it, I was like, "Oh, that looks kind of dope." But at the same time, I was like, "No, this can't be real either," because you just never see the Pope wearing something like that. But when you look at the image quality itself, it was very, very good. Although if you look very closely, you could tell that was AI generated. And it typically kind of looks like very Photoshopped, like it has special filters. Like it's kind of like you can imagine like a filter having been run through the photo, and that's what it kind of looks like. So with the release of version 5 of Midjourney, which basically upgraded the engine that now makes the images a lot more powerful and more realistic, it's become a bigger issue. And I think this is just the beginning, just like the whole Getty lawsuit that's been happening, right? Where they're trying to like sue all these image generating companies using Getty images as a source for learning and conditioning and optimizing images. I think this is just the beginning. And I know, for example, in France, they have this new law that's either being passed or is being close to being passed, where if you're an influencer on Instagram or any sort of social media platform, you have to indicate if your photos were altered in some shape or form. Like if you use a filter or something, or if you use some sort of, you know, app to make yourself look better. And I think that is just the beginning, because one, you know, we kind of have a distorted view right now of what beauty looks like in a lot of people because of social media. So France is kind of like the first country to try to tackle that. But imagine with AI stuff, we need even more verification as the tools get better to know, hey, is this actually real? Like, are Tana Brooks right now live on the podcast, or are these bots right now that are talking? And it's almost like pre-recorded, right? Like so at some point, the tech is going to be so good that you don't even know. So there has to be some sort of law or certification or some sort of verification that shows like, hey, these are indeed the real people. And I think it's going to get a little messy. And I think it's exciting stuff as well, but it's going to be a little bit messy in the beginning. And just rest assured, you know, if we are going to use AI bots or anything like that for us on the show, we will definitely give you a heads up. But for now, we're going to be the real deal.
Yeah, I was reading about this strategy that people are coming up with for applying to jobs. And they say, okay, here's what you do. You take the job description, you take all the requirements, you paste them into ChatGPT, and then you say, make a resume that answers all of these requirements. And so ChatGPT will then pump out a resume that basically puts it to that. And then you kind of like massage it theoretically anyway, to be closer to your experience and bring that in. And then you apply. And if you're a hiring manager, you know, you get this. It's a good thing we partner with companies like Indeed that will be looking out for this stuff. But if you're a hiring manager, all of a sudden you get this resume. It's like, oh my God, this is exactly what I want. It's like, nope, it's ChatGPT. And that's the world we're entering into here.
Well, to your point, the tech is improving so fast that we have to adopt as well around it, right? So the hiring manager has to learn to, one, to be able to detect stuff like this, but also two, get better at leveling up their skills and finding the right people. So yeah, the consumer is getting smarter, but then also it requires and forces us to up-level our skills to be able to look at a resume, quickly identify like if this is the right person, and when we're interviewing them, get better at shortcutting the whole process and say, hey, is this actually the real deal or not? And so I think it has all these interesting byproducts, and that's why I think people are so excited about AI, because yes, it's groundbreaking technology, it's available for you and I, like the everyday people, but then also the ripple effects of that is that it forces innovation everywhere else. And that's what makes the tech so interesting and exciting. And I think we are going to be in this weird transition period where there's going to be a lot of arbitrage. There's going to be a lot of ways for people to be more efficient and sometimes even shortcutting the process to the degree that's even unfair in some cases. But I think over time that will level out as well. So I'm really excited about it, but we'll see where it goes.
Is hiring challenging? Yes. But do you love a challenge? Well, the answer is also yes, thankfully. And you need a hiring partner that can help you rise to that challenge. You need Indeed. Indeed is the hiring platform where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. So instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's powerful hiring platform can help you do it all. Indeed streamlines hiring with powerful tools that find you matched candidates, like with Instant Match. Over 80% of employers get quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed matches their job description the moment they sponsor a job, according to Indeed's US data. I mean, if you're hiring, it's pretty hard to beat Indeed's hiring platform. It gives you the tools to find, interview, and assess people all in one place. And since I gave a stat from Indeed's US data earlier, here's another one. Candidates you invite to apply are 3 times more likely to apply to your job than candidates who only see it in search. Even better, Indeed's the only job site where you only pay for applications that meet your must-have requirements. Indeed is an unbelievably powerful hiring platform, delivering 4 times more hires than all other job sites combined, according to Talent Nest stats. So join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job posts at Indeed.com/TPS. Offers only good for a limited time, so claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/TPS. Indeed.com/TPS. Terms and conditions apply, and if you need to hire, you need Indeed. Have you ever signed up for one of those try it free for 30 days offers and then completely forgot about it until a charge hit your statement? Well, don't worry, you are definitely not alone. Turns out over 80% of people have subscriptions they forgot about. You could be wasting money without even realizing it. Rocket Money helps you find those forgotten subscriptions so you can stop paying for the ones you don't use. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps you lower your bills all in one place. And like I said, over 80% of people have subscriptions they forgot about, and chances are, you're probably one of them. Like that Starz app you sign up for just to watch one show, or maybe that gaming trial you never really used. Rocket Money will quickly and easy find your subscriptions for you, and for the ones you don't want anymore, all you have to do is hit cancel, and Rocket Money will cancel it for you. It's just super easy. Rocket Money also helps you manage your finances in one place and automatically categorizes your expenses so you can easily track your budget in real time, and it'll let you know if anything looks off. Over 3 million people have used Rocket Money, and the average person saves up to $720 a year. That's a lot. So stop throwing your money away, cancel unwanted subscriptions, and manage your expenses the easy way by going to rocketmoney.com/TPS. That's rocketmoney.com/TPS. rocketmoney.com/TPS. All right. The next topic I want to talk about is habits. And Psychology Today released this article called 6 Habits That Are Secretly Making You Miserable. Now, that is obviously a massive clickbait title, and clearly I'm very susceptible to that, but that's fine. I know this about myself. But it really made me wonder if all of us have these kind of internalized habits that are, at the end of the day, really making us miserable. And the 6 habits that they say are making us miserable are, 1, constantly checking your phone. 2, procrastination. 3, comparing ourselves to others. 4, focusing on the negatives. 5, not setting boundaries. And 6, neglecting self-care. Now, that is a pretty, I would say, productivity 101 list. I mean, I think we can all agree that all of those things are probably going to make us miserable. It's kind of like the low-hanging fruit. But do you have any other habits that you think can or secretly making us miserable that we might not have thought of? Or do you disagree with any of these? Do you think any of them on the list are not such a problem after all?
When I saw your article, I went, okay, this is pretty basic. I think everybody will agree with that. If I had to add my own spin to it, I would say multitasking is one that I think most people underestimate, because a lot of people will think that multitasking is a good thing when in fact it's not. Our brain is designed to only be able to focus on one thing at a time and do it very well. And if you multitask, you switch focus back and forth and requires a lot of energy, cognitive load, and also we tend to make more mistakes when we focus in such a way. So it's one of those hidden killers in that sense, where multitasking seems on the outside like a good idea when in fact it's not. So that's one habit I would say that you want to move away from and start focusing on just doing one thing at a time. The other one I would say that I would add to the list is probably some form of perfectionism. So personally, I'm not a huge perfectionist myself, so I don't deal with this as much, but I have a lot of friends who are like that and people that I work with. And it's hard to overcome this, because you can always make a point that this is a good thing and we do need perfectionists, because they level up the products, they level up the quality, they level up everything that they touch and work on. But it can come at a detriment as well, where at some point, good enough is good enough, and any marginal gain is not going to make any difference. And it's sometimes hard to identify what that line is. I think the other one that I would add to the list is overcommitting yourself. This is something that I sometimes struggle with because not that I have a hard time saying no, but I just like to say yes to a lot of different things and just explore what the possibilities are and kind of like shooting bullets in a way and just see what lands and what sticks. And sometimes it can come at the detriment because you're just spread too thin. Your focus is in different places. You can't really do one thing very well. Just like with multitasking, where you like do one or two things at the same time, being overcommitted is like having sunlight come onto the earth and having no magnifying glass, and it's just kind of like widespread all over. Whereas if you have a magnifying glass and you move it in the right direction, that it will, you know, concentrate the sunlight's power to focus on one thing, it can lit almost anything on fire, right? Like it could turn on a leaf on fire. So I like the idea of just focusing on a few things, and most clients that I work with are probably overcommitted. So those are the three that I think are most common.
I like that idea of overcommitment and the differentiation you made, because we always think of overcommitment as not being able to say no, but there's a big difference between not being able to say no and liking to say yes. And I think having that bias towards saying yes is not a bad thing. I think pretty standard productivity advice is you should say no by default. I think there's nothing wrong with having a bias towards saying yes, but also knowing when to say no. And I never really thought of it as an actual distinction before. So if you're listening to this and you find yourself overcommitted, you should maybe ask yourself, is it because your bias towards saying yes is a little too high, that you're a little too eager, or is it that you have trouble saying no? Because the fix to each of those are very different.
Yeah. And when I think about the T framework that we teach, right, which is time, energy, and attention, all of these habits affect one of those three areas at some point. So if you're looking to maximize your time, maximize your energy, maximize your attention, you want to have the right habits in place. And we have the 25X productivity system, which teaches people 25 mindsets and skills to level up their life and achieve productivity mastery. And a lot of those skills that we teach are actually the opposites of what we just talked about. So instead of multitasking, we teach you to focus on one thing at a time, right? Instead of overcommitting yourself, we look at what are the highest priorities in your life and how can you align your schedule around that so that it aligns in such a way so that you can say no to the other things and say yes to what matters most to you. And so when you're looking at this list of habits, like you were saying, Brooks, it's not necessarily these are all like bad. Like, we all are susceptible to these things. Sometimes I still compare myself to other people. Sometimes I don't set boundaries. Sometimes I still procrastinate, like I'm human as well. This is where the Pomodoro technique is so powerful and why I still use it like 15 years later or whatever, since I first discovered it, because we're all human. We're all imperfect. We all have flaws and we all are susceptible to these things. And I think what's powerful, like we're talking about today, is just being aware of them and go, hey, okay, I might be prone to some of these things, but what is the alternative? What can I do about it? So instead of just talking about the negatives, right? What can we actually do proactively? And that's where something like our productivity methods that we teach here at AE come in really handy, because now you have the tools and the skills to do something about this. It's one thing to know about something. It's another thing to be able to use the tools and knowledge to apply it as well. And that's why we're here.
All right. So the next topic I want to bring up is about journaling apps or note-taking apps, really about any apps, and how when you're choosing an app like this, it always involves trade-offs. So then the question is, how do you decide which of those trade-offs is important to you? And this came from a Verge article that was going around called, great title, by the way, My Impossible Search for the Best, Most Powerful, Most Private Journaling App Ever. That's the title of the article. And the author talks about his search for a journaling solution and all of the kind of tensions and trade-offs that come with choosing an app like a journaling app. And he goes through a bunch of different options. I'm not going to list them out here, but you know, paper journal, you could have a paper journal that's around for 100 years, but of course you need it with you and anyone can just open it and read it, all the way to something like Obsidian, which is complex, but is getting better. Data is stored just in plain Markdown, which is great for portability. And he talks about Day One, which is a journaling app. He says it's nice to use. It's built for journaling, has a bunch of features like streaks, topic prompts, all that type of stuff. It's encrypted, but it's Apple only. And because of that encryption, it's really secure, but sometimes you just literally can't add some features you might want to add because it's so locked down. And there's always this tension between having cool, modern, integrated features and also having your data private and protected. And one thing you were talking about Evernote before and how it's probably not going to change too much, I actually looked into this and I couldn't believe that Evernote data is still not encrypted on the servers unless you specifically encrypt the text. This was the knock against Evernote like 10 years ago. And it's still something that people are concerned about. And so the article goes on to talk about how if you're wanting to use what's called a personal app, it's kind of hard, right? Because you start using these apps because you like it for your personal use, but then the developer realizes that really the money is selling the app to businesses. So then they start swinging all the features in that direction. And all of a sudden, these things you value and the trade-offs you decide to make for an app all of a sudden are kind of going out the window because the developer is starting to chase after the money. And so the author, spoiler alert, settled on Day One, which is actually the app that I use too. And have you ever thought of this concept of personal apps, Tan? Like, what do you use to decide what app you're going to use? And I'm curious, what do you use for journaling these days?
So my journaling habit right now is mostly pen and paper. So I have something like a 5-minute journal or like a physical journal that I have at home where I write every single day, typically at the end of the day to help me process my stuff, make sure that my head is empty so I can go to bed feeling like, okay, my mind is clear and my brain doesn't have to process stuff anymore. I can just relax and transition, go into bed. So that's something that I personally use. And sure, like if I'm traveling and I don't have my journal with me, I might not journal, but I might do it digitally then. So I might use something like Evernote, right? And have stuff in there. So I'm not too concerned about that personally. And that's my personal journaling habits. What I took away from the Verge article is, and this is a kind of a funny analogy, but basically the author was describing his process for finding the right journaling app. And what we learn from the article is that everyone has their own value system around what's important for them. And the author basically walked you through what his value system was for picking a particular app. And this is how he concluded to find that Day One was the best option for him. And I think what we should all take away from your article, we will link to in the show notes, is the idea that just like with dating, when you're selecting your life partner and you're dating somebody and you end up marrying that person, like there's certain qualities that you want in that person that are non-negotiable, that is really important to you. And that is something you look for as you're dating and meeting people. It's the same thing with apps. Like you have to know what your personal values are around how you select apps. And I think this way of thinking is relatively new because in 2008 or 2007, when the iPhone came out, like apps were not really a thing. Sure, we had them on the computer and stuff, but now most of us have smartphones where we buy apps, we use apps, we have tablets. This is all relatively new. And the fact that we're buying all these apps and we kind of forget about the evaluation process of these apps because we just tend to look at the app store and go, oh, yeah, this kind of looks cool or someone said this is a good app and then you just buy it right away, right? Nowadays, I think more of us are getting more sophisticated where now we have to think about all the different value systems and decisions that we have around apps that make us choose a particular app because I've been burned a few times where, you know, I downloaded an app, it was free, only to find out later that the developer was like, hey, I can't support this app anymore. I'm going broke. You know what? I'm going to have to shut down this app. And I go, no, like I have all my data in here. What do I do now? And if you've been burned once, that kind of sucks. If you get burned twice, you learn from it, hopefully, because now when you choose the next app where you store your stuff, you go, oh, okay, I don't want this to happen again. So now you have to do your own research and go, okay, is this company funded? Is the developer funding this? One thing we've talked about on a podcast many times is I'm a big fan of subscription models where you pay a monthly or annual fee for apps because one, it makes sure that the app developer gets paid and keeps their, you know, servers alive because they do cost stuff, like nothing is ever free. And also from a developer point of view, like if you create an app one time and you get a one-time payment, there's no incentive for you to create a better app, because if you do, you're not getting paid for it additionally for the work, unless you release a new version, which then, you know, if you go four or five versions in, you still have people using version one that never want to upgrade because they never want to pay for the additional features or whatever. And now you have so much more support, right? Versus just having one version that gets updated that is on a subscription. And so that makes a lot more sense. And I feel like the incentives are a lot more aligned when we have it that way. So I'm a big fan of the subscription model. So whenever I'm picking a productivity app right now, yes, I'm thinking about the longevity of it. So I want to see, you know, what's the business model? Is it well-funded? Who are the backers behind this? Two, what's the pricing model like, right? So is it one-time payments, recurring? Even though I don't like to pay recurring, I know if I'm going to invest in it, and I'm pay recurring, that I'm more also invested in the app itself, so I'm more likely to use it. So, which is kind of funny psychology too. So I think all of us basically have to be a little bit more sophisticated in how we pick apps.
So basically, don't start using an app because you see somebody on YouTube using it. Think of what your criteria is for that category and then go through that and see what is the best app for you. All right, Tan, final topic, and this is less a discussion topic and more a therapy slash accountability session, but why the heck is it so freaking hard to do a consistent weekly review? Like, if there's one question that we get more than any other whenever we do a Q&A session, a webinar, a live masterclass, we always get asked some version of, you know, I know a weekly review is so powerful, but I just can't stick with it. I do it once or twice and then I miss it and then I miss it and then it's gone. So help us all down, please. Why is it so hard to do a consistent weekly review and what can we do about it?
If you're listening to this, you probably read Getting Things Done by David Allen. You've probably heard about the weekly review. You might have even tried to do it. And maybe you've done it once successfully or two or three times, but maybe not consistently. And this is a common complaint we hear from many people. And I think it's because, one, when the first time people do a weekly review, it takes a long time. It takes a really, really long time, sometimes an hour and a half. And then you go, I don't know if I have an hour and a half or 2 hours to do this every single week. Well, here's the secret sauce. If you have a checklist that you can follow, you can oftentimes get it done in 25 or 30 minutes tops and be done with it every single week. Nowadays, when I do a weekly review, it's maybe 25, 30 minutes, I'm good to go. And that's because, one, I have a checklist. And then also, two, it's a skill. It's a habit that you develop over time. So the first time you do something, you kind of suck at it. And it's kind of like when you're learning how to drive a car, right? First time you go, you're like, okay, turn my head over the left shoulder, look at the mirror, you know, look at the rearview mirror. And then you look at the other side mirror, right? And then you're like, okay, let me press the gas pedal. And then you go really slow to move forward. Nowadays, when you step in the car, now you've been driving for a while, you just kind of look at the mirrors, you know, one, two, three, okay, and then you go. Like, that took like maybe 2 seconds to do, whereas when you first started, it might have taken like a minute or so before you felt comfortable starting. It's the same thing with a weekly review. The first time you do it, you're kind of slow at it, you suck at it, that's okay. A checklist is super powerful and helpful, and that makes things go a little bit faster for you because you don't have to reinvent the wheel and think about like, what do I do again at every single step? You just follow the checklist. So if you're struggling right now with the weekly review, I have some good news. One is, here at Asian Efficiency, we're launching a new course called the Weekly Review Blueprints that's coming out very soon. Depending when this episode goes live, it might be out already. But if you go to theproductivityshow.com/review, again, theproductivityshow.com/review, it will link to the page where we have this course. And we've developed this course because we've gotten so many complaints and feedback points from people that they struggle with the weekly review, that we wanted to create a really simple course to help you with that. So it comes with a checklist. It comes with additional material to help you implement a weekly review and how we do it. So I will show how I do it and some of the strategies that we use. But then also it comes with a reminder service as well. So when you enroll for the course, we will offer you this reminder service where you can leave your phone number behind and email. And then we will send you additional tips every single week via your phone, like through a text message or via email, with some additional tips to help you implement it. So we're actually going to help you along the way build this habit. So by the end of the 30 days of going through the course, which only takes like an hour or two to go through, and you'll have a new habit fully developed. So if you're struggling, Totally get that. Brooks, did you struggle when you first start learning about the weekly review? How was that like for you?
Oh, yeah. It's the classic story, right? Exactly what you said. I read Getting Things Done. I'm like, all right, I'm going to do a weekly review. So I would do it at the office and I had the page bookmarked in the GTD book. And then, yeah, I was like, I did it the first time. It was great. Did it the second time. It was great. Then I kind of missed one. I did it again. Then I missed one. Then I missed another one. And then the weekly reviews kind of stopped. And then what happens, right? Your to-do list starts having things on it that shouldn't be there. Your to-do system gets a little out of date. You start missing follow-ups from meetings that you've had. And then you start feeling overwhelmed. You stop trusting your system. And so you stop using it consistently. And then your productivity just nosedives. It's kind of like this quote from Ernest Hemingway. If you've ever read the book, The Sun Always Rises, someone asked the main character how he went broke. And he says, two ways, gradually and then suddenly. And that's kind of the impact of the weekly review. If you miss your weekly review, your productivity kind of starts falling apart and then it can nosedive. So I found things like you said, like having a checklist really helpful, having that realistic time, starting simply. That's what has really worked for me. But like you said, if you have found that you're still having trouble being consistent, which I know a lot of listeners have, check out that productivityshow.com/review. I think it's going to be really helpful.
Yeah, I think the best analogy before we wrap it up here is think of it like your car routine maintenance that you have, right? So we all know we have to change the oil of the engine every few thousand miles or so. And when you go for a checkup, they will actually give you like a little sticker or a note to say, hey, at this mile or this amount of kilometers, depending where you are in the world, you have to come back in and get a new oil change. You know? And then how many of us will ignore that and go, oh, well, you know, I'll add an extra 2,000 or 3,000 miles on top of that because, you know, I can get away with that, right? So even if you miss it, your car still works just A-okay. But then one day you might actually get that orange sign on your dashboard to go, hey, ding, ding, ding. You know, you really have to go in now. And if you continue to ignore that and you don't go in, guess what's going to happen? At some point, that smaller issue becomes a bigger issue and then it'll become really expensive to fix it. And then it becomes kind of painful almost, right? And the same thing is true for the weekly review. When we miss it one time, oftentimes not a huge deal. We miss it twice in a week. It can kind of feel like a big deal, but it's not that big of a deal. We miss it a few times and then at some point we totally forget about it and we realize, oh, wow, like I'm so behind on so many different things. I start to forget ideas. Things are slipping through the cracks. Why is this happening? And oftentimes we can't connect the dots because we don't realize that because we missed the weekly review, that's why we're in the situation we are in today. So if you've tried to get back on track and it hasn't worked for you, I would suggest a different method or a different approach now. And this is why we released our course, the Weekly Review Blueprint. So go check it out, theproductivityshow.com/review. We made it all the way to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for listening to us today. And if there's one action step for today, again, I would say schedule your weekly review, use a checklist. If you don't have one, go get ours. But I would highly suggest that you pick a date and time that you can confidently do the weekly review. Set aside at least 30 minutes if you can, if you're new to it. And I think you're going to find it very beneficial, especially if you haven't done it in a while. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Again, this was The Productivity Show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.